Hello, welcome to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris. This month, why cheaters often claim it didn't mean anything, and why perceptions of what constitutes cheating vary from person to person. Also, changing faces, how women's faces change shape over the menstrual cycle. This is the February edition of the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast from oraclelab.co.uk. Why do humans cheat? Well, the simple answer is probably that we're not as inclined towards monogamy as we like to think we are. We sit somewhere along the infidelity spectrum between the infamously promiscuous Dunnock, a tiny garden bird with a libido that would make even Hugh Hefner blush, and swans, who not only mate for life, but go around smugly advertising the fact by entwining their necks in the shape of a heart, like a floating Hallmark card. But try telling your partner that after you're caught playing away from home. Justifying your sexual generosity, as I like to call it, with reference to biology is a surefire way of solving the problem of infidelity entirely, because once your partner dumps you, you'll have nobody left to cheat on. No, it's best to fall back on that most tried and tested of excuses for a bit of extramarital exercise. Just tell them it didn't mean anything. It's a complete cliché. But that doesn't necessarily mean it isn't true. Or does it? Perhaps we kid ourselves that our infidelities are meaningless because it's the only way to justify our behaviour. Almost everyone condemns cheaters, but presumably a good proportion of those people are cheaters themselves. So does claiming that our particular indiscretion meant nothing somehow let us off the hook, morally speaking? Joshua Foster and Tiffany Misra of the University of South Alabama decided to attempt to untangle the claims, counterclaims, confusion and self-delusion of cheating using a cleverly designed experiment. Rather than recruit as research participants self-confessed cheaters and non-cheaters, which could have made their experiment difficult to properly control, they decided to induce feelings of faithfulness and unfaithfulness in a random sample of people. Participants were told to think about their current or most recent serious relationship, and then they answered a series of questions about how frequently they felt attracted to people other than their primary partner. Also, how much time they spent with those attractive outsiders, and how often they engaged in couple-like behaviours with them, such as talking endlessly on the phone. After completing the questionnaire, half of the participants were told that they'd scored higher than 83% of other participants, meaning they were in the top 17% of the population for propensity to cheat. The remaining participants were told that their scores were in the bottom 17%, giving them the impression that they were relatively faithful. So none of the participants were genuinely super faithful or super promiscuous, but half had been led to believe that they were especially faithful and half that they were especially unfaithful. Next, all the participants completed a so-called trivialization questionnaire. That was a survey that assessed the extent to which they felt their behaviors in relation to attractive non-partners said something about their own personality. So, for example, they were asked things like, how meaningful is the extent to which you committed these behaviours in terms of describing you? Participants who thought the behaviours, the things they'd done with these attractive outside partners, said very little about their own personality, were said to have trivialised the behaviours, to have decided that they didn't say anything special about who they were. Foster and Misra found that people who'd been made to feel as though they're cheaters tend to trivialise their cheating behaviour. On the other hand, people who'd been made to feel they were as pure as the driven snow didn't trivialise their behaviour. They thought that the low scores on the infidelity questionnaire really did say something important about their personality, presumably because it confirmed their suspicions that they were all round good eggs. These results imply that when someone says that a fling didn't mean anything, they really believe this to be true. Only bad people cheat, they think, and I'm not a bad person, so my behaviour must have been an aberration and doesn't reflect my real personality. This is a form of cognitive dissonance, the discomfort felt when a person attempts to hold simultaneously two conflicting opinions. And the researchers did, in fact, show in a follow-up study that trivialisation led to psychological discomfort. But if your heart fails to break for the partner whose deception you've uncovered, and who, in claiming that it meant nothing, causes themselves a measure of mental anguish, then there's always one way you can get even. Just get on the blower to Jeremy Kyle, don't you? Get him on daytime TV, get him on stage. It's better than mucking around with couples therapy, innit? Just get on to Jezza. Everything we've talked about so far sort of presupposes that we know what infidelity actually means. But is there really a consensus about what constitutes cheating? Sure, if you're caught on camera having sex with an ex-partner, you're probably bang to rights. Not much point arguing about that one. But unfaithfulness is a continuum that runs from the most obvious and severe infractions right down to seemingly innocuous exchanges with those your primary partner perceives as rivals. But where along this continuum do we draw the line? What can we agree constitutes cheating? Or can we ever expect to agree at all? Dan Kruger of the University of Michigan decided to find out. He had about 450 students read a list of social behaviours and state to what extent they thought those behaviours constituted cheating. To do this, they used a scale that ran from 0%, Virgin Mary levels of purity, to 100%, the sort of behaviour that would make even Tiger Woods blush. Sexual behaviours, as expected, received the highest scores. Virtually everyone thought that sex constituted cheating. And by the way, yeah, you did hear that right. Virtually everyone. There were one or two people who gave it less than a score of 100% and clearly have a tolerance for behaviour beyond the imagination even of a scientist whose specialist subject is sexual shenanigans. The next highest ratings were for erotic behaviours that fell short of sex, such as texting erotic messages and emailing naked pictures. Although, again, around 12% of people seemed to think that was perfectly okay. Further down the list were behaviours that were more difficult to interpret. Sleeping in the same bed as someone else was thought to be cheating by 68%, and 63% thought holding hands was also out of the question. The most controversial behaviours were spending lots of time with another person, sitting on their lap, or staying in the same hotel room, each of which were considered by around 50% of the participants to constitute infidelity. I suppose the trick there is to pair up with someone who falls in the same 50%, because when an argument starts, not even a referendum is going to clear up who's in the right. Some even less severe infractions still incurred the wrath of a sizeable proportion of the students. Hugging someone for more than 10 seconds was a definite no-no for 35%, and even if you break off the cuddle before the 10 seconds has elapsed, 12% of people still won't be happy. Had a bad day at work and planning on calling an attractive friend to commiserate? Better check first whether your partner is among the 19% of people who consider that a dumpable offence. And if a friend asks for a few coins to feed the parking meter, stop and think. Is your partner one of the 8% who consider it beyond the pale to lend $5 to their potential rival? You know, so far, none of this is especially surprising. Doing someone a favour is fine, but a sexual favour? Not so much. The really interesting results come when we split the participants into groups. For example, half of the participants were currently in a relationship, and these participants were less likely to forgive holding hands, kissing on the cheek or lips, and sharing a bed or hotel room. Maybe this is because people who have a partner have more to lose, and so are more sensitive to those middle-of-the-road, is-it-cheating-or-isn't-it type behaviours. If you don't have a partner, you stand to gain personally by telling yourself, and perhaps also telling the already spoken for object of your affections, that a room for two at the local Days Inn is completely above board. Similarly, persons who scored highly on an attachment anxiety questionnaire, which measures the feelings of distress felt when one imagines the breaking of social connections, tended to classify more of the behaviours as cheating. If you're frightened of losing a partner, it probably pays to be more suspicious about where that $5 bill went from their wallet. Until that is, they dump you for snooping through their stuff. I guess it's all swings and roundabouts. Women tended to rate almost all items as being more indicative of infidelity than men did. Now, depending on how you want to look at it, you could take this to mean that men are eternally frisky sex maniacs who'll do anything for a furtive fumble, even pretending that behaviours that obviously are cheating are innocent. Or you could conclude that women are overly suspicious, too keen to classify innocuous interactions as potentially prurient. A more balanced interpretation would be that women are more concerned by the prospect of emotional infidelity than men are. Men are primarily perturbed by the idea of their partner having sex with someone else. Now, since most of the behaviours on Kruger's list are emotional in nature, things like sharing secrets, making phone calls, providing emotional and financial support, the questionnaire probably triggered women's stronger aversion to emotional infidelity, and that meant they got higher scores than men. If you're interested in why women and men should differ in their perceptions of infidelity according to its sexual and emotional components, then head over to the podcast blog. That's psychologyofattractivenesspodcast.blogspot.com and click on the tag for infidelity. I've covered the topic several times before, and you can also find the previous special episode on infidelity from June 2012. Finally, this month, we leave infidelity behind and get back to one of my favourite topics, concealed ovulation. Unlike chimpanzees, women's backsides don't swell up and turn pink once a month. So researchers understandably have assumed that women must have evolved to hide the fact of their fertility, most likely from men, perhaps because uncertainty about the timing of ovulation promotes long-term bonding. If a man can't tell when sex is likely to result in pregnancy, he'd better stick around with one partner, rather than flitting from woman to woman as and when the likelihood of their conceiving is highest. By the way, it's worth pointing out that none of these drives are necessarily conscious. Evolution doesn't care if women are consciously concerned about hiding their ovulatory status from men, just as it couldn't give two hoots whether men are consciously aware that to maximise their reproductive fitness, they should try to partner exclusively with fertile women. Natural selection can produce changes in biology and behaviour quite happily, whether we're aware of what's going on or not. Now, over the last decade or so, researchers have begun to realise that ovulation in humans may not be 100% concealed. Only last month I talked about some new research that showed women are much more likely to wear red or pink clothes around ovulation, which is likely to be just as conspicuous a cue as a bonobo's bulging backside. This month, however, researchers have uncovered something perhaps even more astounding, that women's faces actually change shape on a 28-day cycle. Elisabeth Oberzaucher of the University of Vienna photographed the faces of 20 normally cycling women every day for a month. She then analysed the shape changes in the photographs using a technique called geometric morphometrics, just a fancy way of saying they drew loads of dots on each face, around the lips, the nose, the eyes, and so forth, and then used a computer to analyse whether those dots changed location over time. Oberzaucher found that they did, and that around ovulation, when women are most fertile, their lips are fuller, their noses less broad, and their jawlines more feminine, compared to a week or so later in the cycle when fertility is reduced. This sounds so utterly bizarre, I think the first and probably most sensible reaction would be to say, surely not. The shape of our faces is dependent upon bone and cartilage, and how can they change every 14 days and then change right back again? It just sounds implausible. Well, most likely, bone and cartilage don't change. Far more plausible is the idea that fluid is retained for brief periods of time beneath the skin, and those levels of fluid change over the month, thereby slightly shifting the shape of the face. The differences are so subtle that they may not even be perceivable, and if they are, perhaps only to the woman herself, or maybe to her long-term partner, who's used to seeing her every day and more likely to notice any slight change. We already know from previous research that women do feel more attractive at ovulation. And this may be partly because you wake up, look in the mirror, and think, hey, I look pretty damn good today. And now you know why. Science. That's all for this episode. If you'd like to find out more about the research featured in today's show, head over to www.oraclelab.co.uk and click on podcasts. You can also keep up with new research throughout the month by following Oracle Lab on Twitter. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris.